You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. I am Allison Sutter from MLB.com. There are five teams that are anxiously awaiting the start of spring training. Some have a little bit more optimism than others when it comes to their chances to make the postseason, but pretty much all of these teams feel that they have things that are starting to come together a little bit and not a lot of unanswered questions as they start spring training. Of course, the world champion San Francisco Giants didn't have to do a whole lot to maintain what they think will be a contention in the NL West, and then the Padres, all eyes will be on them to see how this new group comes together. So overall, the NL West looks to be in pretty good shape starting spring training. I'm joined by Ken Gernick, who covers the Dodgers for MLB.com. And Ken, the Dodgers, of course, just had their fan fest, which makes for a great opportunity for the media to catch up with the players and for the fans. I guess there was about 22,000 in attendance, which is pretty awesome. But I thought it was interesting, Zach Greinke, who I don't think he's, I don't think he counted anybody truly outspoken on the team, but he did speak kind of at length with the media recently and said some interesting things. First, he has an opportunity to opt out of his contract after the season, and he said he didn't really want to address it now, but he might talk about it in spring training. Where does that stand, and where do you see that maybe going?
Well, just reading between the lines, it doesn't take a lot of brilliance to do this. It's about money, you know. He has no problem with playing for the Dodgers. In fact, it sounds like he likes it more than he thought he would when he signed. But when he signed, he took the best offer. That's why he went playing for the Dodgers. It wasn't because of new ownership or anything else, really. It was about the money. They had the most money to offer. So my guess is that he'll try to work out a contract extension that would put him back at a market level for a pitcher of his talents. Since he did sign, the numbers have gone straight up. So I'm sure he just wants more money and more years. I wouldn't be surprised if he opts out, as long as he believes that he's going to get that from somebody. But it does sound like his preference would be just to stay with the Dodgers, just to adjust the contract. Now, whether they have any interest in doing that, you know, that gets to the end of the season. That's really not something they seem to be interested in talking about right now.
Okay, because I was just wondering, because the way he said that maybe he would talk about it in training, and maybe he sounded like he thought that maybe this would be resolved at spring training, because if it's not, then why would he not talk about it now and talk about it in a month? But you think this will be more toward the end of the season, that it'll be addressed?
Well, I'm sure he wants to address it now.
Okay.
And perhaps the team will too, but the team has made it pretty clear that they would like to get away from these 7, 8, 9 year contracts, the kind of contracts that burden them the way, say, Matt Kemp, Andre Ethier contracts have. They want to go back to developing their own players and not have to spend so much money out on the free agent market. So extending Zach Greinke until he's into his mid-30s probably would run counter to the way they've been talking about what they want to do. I'm sure, again, it's about the money. It's about whether the Dodgers are willing to step up and extend him at the kind of money that he feels he'd be able to get on the free agent market. Now, chances are he and his agent will make a run at the Dodgers if they haven't already. The Dodgers like to play this kind of close to the vest, and because he's not a free agent, really until the end of the season, if he pops out, it's not something that they're going to want out there right now.
So he was, he was asked about how he saw the makeup of the team now and after all the offseason moves, and he was pretty candid about it. I don't know, it depends on sort of, you know, how you read his quotes with how it's taken. He did express feeling like he wasn't surprised at all, that there were a lot of changes because he saw what happened in the front office. He figured that changes on the field were on the way. But he also said he's not really ready to say if he thinks the team is better than it was last year. Did you glean anything that he felt like maybe he was having some negative feelings for it, or do you think that he's really just like, you know, the defense is better, but maybe the offense isn't quite as good and the jury's really still out as far as the way the guys on the team sort of see the team?
Well, I think he kind of looked at the way I look at it, the way some people look at it, is you had a 94-win team and you blew it up. So it's going to take a lot for this team to be better than last year's team. And he didn't say that it wouldn't be. He just didn't. It just isn't a slam dunk. You know, it could also be worse than last year's team. And what he really said was, we're just going to have to see how it plays out. You know, to be able to comment now on whether it's better or worse without seeing this dramatically changed team play, it would be just a guess. And he wasn't willing to take that guess. The only thing he would say, again, reading between the lines, is that you couldn't easily say that it's a better team now after having won 94 games and getting rid of two of your best offensive players. It's hard to make that case that this is now a better team. And so he wasn't willing to do that. But he also didn't criticize the changes. He acknowledged the fact that if they changed the front office, they were going to change the roster. He acknowledged the fact that some people feel that the defense was bad last year. He didn't seem to agree with that. So he's on the fence. I didn't take it as a criticism of management, but I didn't take it as a complete support of what they did. More like I'm on the fence and I want to see it to believe it.
What do you think of the ownership group? Do you think there's going to be a patience here? Like you said, I mean, there were a lot of changes, and nobody really knows how this whole thing is going to shake out. Is there, I don't know if it's like a grace period, but, I mean, if things don't work out, like in the upcoming season, do you feel like the ownership is kind of all in on this with the new front office, and that it will just understand the ebb and flow of these things, or do you think that it'll be kind of a panic thing?
Well, I think the fact that they clean the front office out is proof right there that they're not patient. They expected to win a World Series yesterday, you know, and they came
right in
basically promising one. So, I think that they will make changes until they win. And, a dramatic house cleaning of the front office is the first step of that. I'm sure that while they may not say so, that Don Mattingly's on the hot seat. And their minor league system now is going to be on the hot seat because they haven't produced enough players to make it so that they don't have to keep going into the free agent market. They had to sign two more free agent pitchers in their mind because the minor league system just didn't produce quality young pitching. So I think there's a lot of areas that are under the gun and have to prove themselves. There's no guarantee that Jock Peterson will be a star coming right out of the minor league, even though he's coming off a 30-30 season, and he's got a spot to win if he's good enough. So as far as patience, no. This front office, this ownership is not patient, and they expect to win.
Yasiel Puig, he doesn't speak out a lot, but when he does, it's always entertaining. And he feels that the Cardinals are the Dodgers' biggest rival, which is kind of cool because the guy that's coming into the majors when he did, I mean, that would kind of be the way I'd feel about it too. But I've been talking to some of the other reporters, and I wanted to get your take on it. Also, Will Leach from Sports on Earth, he had a recent column where he just listed all the teams and then their top three rivals. And so Will Leach said it was the Giants for the Dodgers. It's the Giants, the Angels, and the Cardinals. Obviously, we know that the Giants are a big rival, but do you kind of understand where Puig is coming from, that he would see the Cardinals as the biggest rival given the last few postseasons? But overall, I mean, you've been, in this industry a long time. Do you feel that they are like the third team, that the Dodgers are a rival risk, or do you think that there's somebody that's being left off?
Well, I think there's different definitions of rivalry, and from the fans, for history's sake, it's the Giants, both going back to New York days, and also just the Dodger Giants since they've been out here for 60 years. But from Puig's, two-year slice as far as what he's witnessed, the Cardinals are the team that bounce them out of the playoffs each year. So clearly from a player's standpoint, it isn't about emotion, oddly enough, for a guy as emotional as Puig. But it's just simply the facts that the Cardinals are the team that keep getting in the way. So, and from a player standpoint, because it's not emotion, it's about winning and success, he's right. The Cardinals, everything goes through the Cardinals if you're the Dodgers. So, again, I think it just goes back to the way you define rivalry. And because he's only been a Dodger for 3 years, two of those years they've been bounced out of the playoffs by the Cardinals. That's his frame of reference.
And it's kind of nice to see, a rivalry be defined by what's going on the field. I was just speaking with Steve Gilbert from the Diamondbacks, and of course, the Diamondbacks' biggest rival is the Dodgers, and it's just because of this bad blood and these silly things that have happened between the two things and the pool incident. That's really not, and of course, the Diamondbacks are a young team that haven't been around that long, so it's hard to define a rivalry for them. But it is kind of unfortunate that would create a rivalry when it's just a bunch of kind of immature foolishness that's happened between two teams. It kind of takes away from what an actual rivalry is.
Well, again, it depends on your definition of rivalry. And here when you're dealing with two different languages, maybe there's, something lost in the translation. But a rivalry versus as far as a team that you hate because you play them all the time and you have emotions versus a team that just keeps getting in your way of advancing, those are two different types of teams. And you might say that they're both rivalries, but in a way they're much different. The Dodgers do have an emotional rivalry with the Giants and a historic rivalry. They have an emotional rivalry with the Diamondbacks. I don't know about the rivalry with the Cardinals, but they can't beat them in the postseason. So that's the team that prevents them from getting to the World Series. And that's, I think, where Puig was really coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I prefer a Dodgers-Cardinals rivalry over a Dodgers-Diamondbacks rivalry. But everybody has their own taste. Anyway, Ken, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Allison, thanks.
I'm here with my colleague Chris Haft, who covers the Giants for MLB.com. And, Chris, I found it interesting. I was reading some of your coverage, and you were talking about the starting rotation and how that was going to shake out. And you sort of alluded to the fact that you were a little bit surprised that Ryan Vogelsong's name hadn't come back up in the wake of Tim Hudson's injury. I don't know if you were foreshadowing, if you had like some inside scoop, but all of a sudden, not too long later, he did re-engage with the Giants and signed. So that probably didn't come as any big surprise. I mean, it's sort of a logical move, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yes, Allison, especially once Hudson and once Hudson's injury cropped up, even though the Giants are saying he's going to be ready for opening day, at his age, which is 39, nothing's a sure thing. And they could get Vogelsong back, a guy, a known quantity, for a relatively low price as insurance in case something happens with Hudson, with Lincecum, who's trying to regain his form, with King, who's overcoming not one but two surgeries, one to his elbow and one to his ankle, in case Jake Peavy keeps on pitching like he did in the postseason last year. So there's a lot of ifs in that rotation. And, Vogelsong was obtained to maybe reduce some of the uncertainty.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, when you list all of those, we've talked about it a lot this offseason and just how many uncertainties do surround the starting rotation. I mean, Vogelsong, everyone was kind of bidding him a fond farewell. And it's really not just Hudson that they have to protect themselves against. And it's all about, providing depth. But now when you talk like that, it almost seems surprising that it took, like, Hudson's situation for them to get the ball rolling. It was, or maybe I'm off on that. Maybe it was like a combination, but it just seemed like his name wasn't coming up that much in the offseason, if at all.
Yeah, no, it was a combination of things. His name wasn't coming up too much. I think, three or four teams had interest, but he was always like the second choice pretty much everywhere, or even the third choice at places like Arizona, Houston, what have you. Minnesota, his name came up there early on, but that was just, I don't think there was anything really to that at that time. He is a serviceable pitcher. He made the All-Star team in 2011, National League All-Star team. He can, when things are going right, he can be a 500 or so pitcher. And this day and age, that's the kind of guy who plugs in pretty well in the backs of pitching rotations.
And he's said on the record, and I guess, I mean, he seems to be a guy who is, pretty versatile and will do whatever the team wants of him. I mean, there is a chance that he could actually move to the bullpen. And so I guess that those are things that have to be worked out ahead of time when they're talking. I mean, it wasn't just that he was, I mean, he was in Houston apparently like taking a physical. So, I mean, who knows really where the, like how the timeline worked out, but all the reports were coming out of Houston that he was in town. And then it was just really weird because he was saying to some of the media here, like, well, I'm not really ready to comment on this. And I mean, it was just kind of strange that he was like taking their calls and yet telling them that he wasn't really prepared to say anything. It was one of those like really odd situations. But I guess going back to San Francisco, knowing that he could be relegated to the bullpen was still maybe more attractive than maybe going somewhere else.
Yeah, I guess he'd rather pitch in the bullpen in San Francisco than start somewhere else. It is interesting what happened with Houston. I guess he talked with A.J. Hinch and maybe somebody smacked his gum at the wrong time, you know. I mean, I don't know what it was, but I've been told I'll get the full story, but not yet, not now.
Well, when you do get the full story, you have to tell us because I'm dying to know also. It seemed really – and I'm really glad – I mean, not that – I mean, there's, you know, there's great things about pitching everywhere and, you know, just being on a major league team, and certainly finances have a lot to do with, like, where guys go. But I'm glad that Vogelsong understands that, you know, there's a pretty good thing going on there in San Francisco, and sometimes you just want to stick with what you know, especially when it's, you know, the Giants. But moving on, you know, it's also interesting just from like talking a little bit about who will be the leadoff hitter. And of course, Angel Pagan, it looks like he's going to continue to do that. But it's also, again, you have to have insurance. You have to have plan A, plan B, plan C. I think a lot of people sort of don't understand the importance of having depth. And when you have people with injury histories or inconsistencies or whatever, you can't just slot them in and not have something that, you know, might be a better option throughout the season. So they signed Nori Aoki, which I thought was a great signing. And he could also possibly slide into the leadoff spot. Is that something that you think that they'll kind of play around with at spring training?
Exactly, Allison. I think they will play around. Bruce Bochy will play with it in spring training, see who, fits. And it may not be a 162-game thing. It may be, you know, 80 games, you know, 85 games Aoki, you know, 75 games Pagan, or, you know, it's just some combination of the two. At least Bruce has options now, or one very good option, you know, with Aoki if Pagan, who's missed big chunks of the last two seasons with injuries, if he goes down again.
Yeah, I liked that signing. I thought it was kind of funny. He had just played them in the World Series. But, you know, I remember it kind of reminded me just like not of the offensive production, but Carlos Beltran when he was traded to Houston 10 years ago, and he just like had this great postseason. And then, of course, he, you know, the contract that he ended up signing was largely based on the postseason he had. And I just think Aoki, like, I mean, his defense and his speed was just amazing. And I think we all were able to see that a little bit more in October. I think his stock kind of rose through that, and that probably helped him with this contract.
Oh, sure. You know, the Giants didn't do a whole lot. They tried to get people to take their money. I know it's a kind of a cynical way of saying it. You know, earlier in the offseason with Pablo Sandoval and John Lester, but at least here, you know, in this situation, you know, they, as Brian Sabian put it, they spread their money around a little bit differently, maybe in a little more modest fashion, and as a result, they got, you know, a serviceable player. So, and maybe a couple more with if you count McGehee, and he's the only other significant player newcomer they've brought in. But it'll just be interesting to see how it all plays out.
I thought the list of the non-roster invites was interesting just because, like, nine of their top prospects are in that mix. I know that teams usually invite, you know, a couple of their top prospects. Is this normally how they do it, where they have so many guys that are really considered kind of the future of the organization be in big league camp? Or is this kind of a little bit different than what they used to do?
In my experience, Allison, which is somewhat limited, but still, since I started covering them, they have not hesitated to bring their top prospects into camp. And I remember in 2005, Matt King was there. This is it's just as serious as can be. And sure enough, we saw him that August in 2006 or 2007. Tim Lincecum showed up in camp, all nice and polite and quiet and unassuming and everything. And while all the Barry Bonds hype was swirling around him, it took just a little more than a month before we saw Lincecum in the San Francisco uniform. So, yeah, they want to get a look at these guys. They didn't get they got a little bit of a look at some of them last year, not all. And I think they want to, you know, with a rotation that's kind of getting long in the tooth, they want to see what they've got.
So it's not just a matter of giving these guys big league experience so much. It's not like getting their feet. Well, I mean, that's part of it, is just kind of getting them around the environment and just and understanding how Major League spring training works and getting them around the veterans. But they could actually make a little bit of an impression, even if they don't make the team right out of spring training.
I think that opportunity is there, yes. Especially for guys like Clayton Blackburn and Chris Stratton, Ty Block, and of course, Kyle Crick, number one prospect, who's a little younger than the other guys, but you know, he could come in a hurry.
Do you remember years ago when the Rockies had like 80 guys in spring training? They invited like 25 pitchers. Do you remember that?
I'm laughing because no, I don't remember that, but I'm laughing because I remember some, and we both have this experience, Allison, covering the Astros. Way back when, I remember they had like 67 or 70 guys in camp. You know, just, it was, oh gosh, it was like open tryouts or something. But, you know, some teams, I mean, for me, you know, I don't know what they need with 22 more guys in camp, but I mean, there are people they want to get a look at. So, this is the time to do it, and so they're taking advantage of that.
Yeah, but I mean, I understand all that, but at the same time, I mean, there were guys that pitched like a third of an inning, like the entire spring, and then got released. I mean, there's still several years ago, Brad Mills, when he started managing the Astros, they had like four split squad games or something. It's like they had all these guys they wanted to look at, and it was absolute chaos. And at some point, you have to cut it off because you still have your regular guys that are actually going to be on a team that have to get innings in. And yeah, I don't know. It was just a mess because guys were pitching a third of an inning and then they were done. And I don't know that anything was really accomplished from that Rocky spring. But anyway, I'm just getting off on a tangent. So I want to Richard Justice had a cool column on MLB.com about Brian Sabian, just the, like what he does, like what makes him such a good general manager. And there's really so many intangibles that come along with being a GM. So you have, you know, you have to wear a lot of different hats. But just through your years of covering the Giants and with Brian Sabian, like, what is it? Does he have a magical touch? Is he just like really patient? Is he not a panic guy? Is he, you know, he just seems to know when to make the right moves and when not to make a move. And what is it about him that makes him a good general manager?
Allison, I think you hit it with the patience. You know, everybody feels the urgency come trade deadline time. He tries to stay as calm as possible. He almost always does something, whether it's getting rid of somebody or acquiring somebody useful. But he does it, but he never feels like he has to do something at that time. Even if there's a great need, you know, he's not going to let the urgency overcome or overwhelm him. He's able to keep things in perspective. He does have patience. I've seen him with players who I thought he was going to go send them to the minors after they fouled up something. And he just actually would just go over and just talk to them, calm them down, say, hey, it's okay. You're still our guy. That's a sign of Brian Sabian that probably nobody ever sees because it happens behind closed doors, you know, in the clubhouse. But, and I think, there, you know, sure, some other GMs are probably just as, quote-unquote, touchy-feely, but, you know, Brian combines that, you know, with sound baseball knowledge, with good advice from his, you know, assistants, and, you know, he's made the whole thing work. He's not infallible. He's made a couple of bad trades and maybe a ill-advised move here or there. But for the most part, it's a high-risk business. He's cut down on the risks.
Yeah, and there's no such thing as unlimited job security in the industry where we work. But I think that if anybody has it, it's probably a general manager who's won 3 World Series in the last 5 years. So he's sitting in a pretty good seat right now. Anyway, Chris, thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Here with Corey Brock, who covers the Padres for MLB.com. It has been a busy offseason for Corey, and now it's about to be a very busy spring training for Corey. So, Corey, there's a couple interesting things that have been going on lately, just things that have been written. And, with Mark Kotze being the new hitting coach, and we talked about him like 3 months ago, when that whole thing went down. And I just think it's really interesting because he's got a whole new, a completely new team to work with in his first year as a hitting coach. That might be a kind of interesting dynamic. He seems to be pretty excited about it. But what do you think about all of that? Just like really having so many new players that he doesn't really have a history with yet.
Well, yeah, how about this? Yeah, as a first-year hitting coach, a guy that's only 2 years removed from his playing days, and certainly a guy that's privy to the Padres' offensive struggles because he was a part of it just 2 years ago, and certainly understands the dynamic that's gone on here. And suddenly he shows up, he's hired Allison, and then they go out and make a trade for Matt Kemp, Justin Upton, Derek Norris, Will Myers, and suddenly he's got a boatload of new faces to work with and proven offensive commodities. So, yeah, I know he's excited. The Padres are excited to have him work with these guys. And, the hitting coach job is an interesting one. And, you talk to players and you kind of get a lot of different variations of opinions on, they all agree these guys are valuable, okay, first and foremost. But, I think guys get different things from the hitting coach. Sometimes it's mechanical. It's inspirational, and sometimes it's relating something that you went through as a player to something maybe they're going through. And I think that Kotze played in the league for so long and is really a fairly recent player. I think he's going to be able to relate a lot of things to guys. So I think it's going to be a pretty good mix. He does have a very good assistant hitting coach, Alonzo Powell, who's been with the team the past couple of years. He's with him and will kind of help him out along the way. That's kind of become the norm with a lot of these teams now, just because players show up so early to the field now, and the indoor hitting cages and the video work these guys do now, that the teams feel like they need two guys kind of working with players at all times. So, but yeah, it's certainly a very good situation for Mark Kotze to walk into.
It's funny, I wrote a long story several months ago about hitting coaches and do the best hitters make the best hitting coaches? And the answer is no, ultimately. But also, yeah, they are psychologists, they're big brothers, they're mechanics, there's certain guys that you just kind of have to listen to them. There's other guys that need a lot of guidance. And I don't know, I mean, do hitting coaches watch a lot of video like during the off season? I mean, do you think Kotze was studying up on a bunch of hitters he really doesn't have anymore? And does he have to start completely over?
Well, that's a good point. No, hopefully he didn't get too deep into the roster. That's a good point. I don't know exactly what his preparation was once he was hired, and how heavily involved he got into looking at swings of players who are no longer with the team. And I knew at least during the winter meetings, Bud Black talked a lot about how he was going to regiment things a little differently in spring training. There was going to be a lot more on the field work right from the get-go in terms of drills, not just BP, but doing a lot of different things on the field to get these guys, get these guys ready to go from day one. This is a franchise that, for whatever reason, has gotten off to some awfully, awfully slow starts, really debilitating slow starts, and just dug themselves big holes and haven't been able to get out of them for whatever reason. So, I think they feel like, with the makeover of the roster, if they can get these guys, hitting, get them really going from day one in April, that they can get off to a strong start and then see what happens from there. So, you know, like I said, I know everybody's excited about this. You know, he wasn't necessarily their first choice. You know, going into the whole process, you know, as I wrote when they hired him, you know, Mark Kotze was sitting in on these interviews, just asking questions, being part of the interview process, which is kind of funny. And then, you know, I think A.J. Preller and Bud Black were listening to some of the questions he was asking, and they thought, hey, why not this guy? So, you know, I think it's going to be a good fit for everyone.
There's an interesting column on the Padres website written by Tracy Ringlesby just about how the Padres are hoping to follow the route taken by the Tigers in terms of building their team and sort of building their team to just to be in line with their ballpark, which, as we know, the Tigers had a massive overhaul and sacrificed the 2003 season to be one of the worst ever in history. Not one or two losses short of being the actual worst team in history, but it's still, you know, kind of rough times. And of course, the Padres have never gotten to that point. But then the Tigers, you know, they started building the farm system, obviously, and is adding the right pieces offensively to become the juggernaut that they became just 3 years later. Do you think that was something that Preller had in mind? I mean, has he ever kind of acknowledged that or compared? Kind of made comparisons to the Tigers franchise? Do you think that that's something that the front office had in the back of its mind, like, hey, maybe we can do this too?
You know, that's nothing that he's really talked about. I know he kind of came in with the mentality of we want to win now, which, you know, I know it's kind of a tired cliche. And, you know, they gave him 5 years right out of the chute, which was kind of unheard of. And, you know, I kind of thought that this was going to be something that was going to take some time. You had some interesting pieces in the minor league system already that they were going to kind of build that way. But lo and behold, they made all these deals now. You know, I think, you know, it's funny you talk about the ballpark, and there's been some modification changes to the ballpark. And I know they did one in Detroit as well. And you've had different regimes come through and different drafting philosophies. So, yeah, you know, people always talk about what's the ideal Petco player? How do you find a player that could succeed there? And I think people have ultimately kind of come back around and decided to just find kind of the best all-around fit. And they've decided that looking at Petco Park that, you know, for you sort of have this misnomer that it's this cavernous field now. You know, the modifications have helped. It plays a little bit more neutral. And the biggest thing I think Preller has noticed, Allison, is that he's been told it, and now I think he saw it over the last 2 months of the season when he was in charge. This right-handed power plays pretty well in the ballpark, that if you square it up from the right-hand side, it's going to go. And I think if you look at the moves that he's made this offseason, they're sort of indicative of that. Justin Upton, Matt Kemp, Derek Norris, you know, he can square something up. Will Myers, this is going to be an awfully, awfully right-handed heavy lineup. And I know some of the naysayers are like, well, there's not enough left-handers in the mix. Well, you know, you look at where this offense was last year, and you look at the upgrades they made, and I think that's kind of nitpicking a little bit. You know, I think the upgrades they made are very substantial, very notable, and like I said, it's going to be a very right-handed hitting lineup. Ultimately, I guess it doesn't matter how you score runs, but I think they feel like, you know, they can maybe put up a three spot on the board with one swing here with some of these guys in the lineup. So, yeah, Petco Park, it's been funny to watch and listen to people talk about it and, you know, watch some of their draft philosophies over the years. But, you know, I guess if you had one group from start to finish, again, the ballpark opened in 2004, but, you know, we've had several groups come through here, several drafts, several scouting directors, and they've all sort of had different opinions on the subject. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you're looking for the best players, the best talent, and maybe at the end of the day, maybe the best power.
I read something that you wrote recently, and it kind of got me, it piqued my curiosity a little bit. I mean, they were so all in on Sandoval. I mean, and they actually, in terms of the offer, I believe it was more than anybody else. And then after they lost out on him, Preller said that the wheels just kept turning, and they just, like, immediately went to plan B, plan C, you know, and all that. But my question is, I mean, would all of this have happened, do you think, if they had signed Sandoval? I mean, like, I'm sure some of the moves would have been made, but there would have been so much less financial flexibility had they been able to find Pablo Sandoval. Do you think that that's kind of where it would have stopped if they had gotten him? And would any of this craziness that we saw, would any of this have happened?
Well, that's a question I asked him, and I thought that was interesting too. And I think a lot of people lost sight of that after that mid-December trading spree that, you know, that, yeah, they were all in on him. And that's a term that they use. This isn't like something I made up. You know, this is a term that the Padres internally use, all in. Mm-hmm. You know, if they had gotten him, what would the landscape of their offseason look like? And what if they would have gotten Yasmani Tomas? Same thing. Would it look a little bit different as well? So it's hard to say. You know, they won't look you in the eye and give you a straight answer there, because maybe they don't really know that for themselves. You know, but it would have looked different. I think, you know, the camp thing probably could have been something that they probably still could have gone down the road on. They still like the player an awful lot. So, but you know, I think that they couldn't have been nearly as active as they were. Maybe Justin Upton wouldn't have happened. Maybe Derek Norris wouldn't have happened. But it's funny, you know, you kind of get turned down by that first reply on your prom date, and lo and behold, you're the second one you end up with. It's maybe the girl you marry.
Exactly. And I just one last thing. I just thought it was kind of funny. I was reading some of the coverage about how when the Padres got the All-Star game for 2016. And somebody from the Padres was saying, like, that having the winter meetings there really helped argue their case that they could really handle an All-Star game with all the logistics. Because, of course, you know, I think a lot of people understand you sort of have to make a bid and you have to show that you've got, you know, a great facility that can accommodate everything, including media, enough hotels, convention center. But I just thought it was funny, like, that they would need the winter meetings. I mean, anybody could go to that area. You know, near the ballpark and just that downtown area, that stretch, and say, well, this would be like the ideal place for an All-Star game. I mean, it sounded a little funny to me to say, like, well, we never could have had this if it wasn't for the winter meeting, showing that we could really handle this. I mean, San Diego is so much better equipped than a lot of cities that we go to for some All-Star game. Did that kind of strike you as a little odd?
Well, maybe, yeah. It's probably a little bit of an oversimplification that San Diego was somehow like this great secret and that we just discovered this. But I think maybe what they were trying to get to, at least in explaining that, was, you know, it allowed them to kind of have this impromptu site visit, if for nothing else, the major league people that were here for the winter meetings were able to kind of come over to Petco Park. You know, they already had the proposal. That was all done in November. But it allowed them to come over and kind of take a look around and walk around and see for themselves with their own eyes, you know, not looking at artist rendering, or not looking at, some photos or some video, but kind of see for themselves kind of how this all works. And I think, you know, I don't know if that necessarily sealed the deal, but I think it helped them. You know, maybe it's at the end of the day, what you were sort of explaining and what I wrote was kind of a nice, tidy little cliche to it all. And, you know, who knows how much it helped. Maybe it helped a little bit. But, you know, I think the winter meetings, having it here and having San Diego put on a really good show helped.
Yeah, I think that the twin setup this past year is probably one of the best that I've ever been a part of, just as far as like everything kind of being in a triangle, from the hotel to the convention center to the ballpark. But I think San Diego, I don't think anyone's going to want to have an All-Star game anywhere else after it's in San Diego. So we shall see. Corey, thank you. Kiss the babies for me, and we'll talk to you soon. I am here for our sort of weekly chat with Thomas Harding, who covers the Rockies for MLB.com. And Thomas, it's been really fun this entire offseason speculating on what the Rockies can do, and I think that we have stretched that out better than possibly anybody could to turn this into like 12 or 13 minutes of what they could do every week. But now they finally did something, so this is really a very exciting day for both of us, because we can talk a little bit about Kyle Kendrick. So they needed some pitching help, and they also needed a ground ball pitcher to fill that role. And it seems like Kyle Kendrick sort of brings a lot to the table. And it wasn't, this is a late signing, but this definitely wasn't a cheap signing. So can you tell us a little bit about what the logistics are around his contract and what they're expecting from him?
Well, they're expecting him to be durable and keep the ball low in the zone and get some ground balls. When you are putting together a pitching staff for the Colorado Rockies, you're not necessarily going to get the guy that you just
bring in and say he's going to give us 200 innings and X number of strikeouts and X number of wins, because it's just very hard to predict performance here. So the Rockies, they were patient throughout the offseason. They looked at a number of trades, but they also had Kyle Kendrick on their radar throughout the whole thing. And it all came together this week. He got a one-year $5.5 million deal. And also there's another, I think, $500,000 available to him if he pitches 190 innings. So basically you're not asking to bring in a super ace, a Roger Clemens type of guy to dominate here, because that doesn't happen. What you're doing is bringing in a guy who can deal with pitching in a hitter's park. He's done it in Philadelphia, can get ground balls, which he did in Philadelphia. If the ball flies out of the stadium, can he keep the team in the game? They need that type of pitcher for this staff, and Kyle Kendrick does fit the bill for the Rockies.
And he uses mostly his sinker. He gets about almost half of the balls hit or ground balls. 30 years old. He pitched 199 innings last year. So this is, I don't want to say like it's, $5.5 million is not chump change, but really everything else, he kind of really fits in. Are you a little surprised maybe that it went this late into the offseason before they signed him?
No, I didn't, especially when Jeff Breidich took over as the general manager, and he basically said that he is going to improve this club, but he's not out to make a bunch of headlines early in the offseason, and he certainly didn't do that, as we've discussed many times. You know, we spent a lot of time speculating on what would happen and when it would happen. He's able to bring in Kendrick to help the rotation. It is a fairly young rotation with guys like Jordan Lyles and Tyler Matzek, but also you do have a couple of stabilizers in Jorge De La Rosa, and if he's healthy, which all signs point to, Jolys Chacin. So he fits in. He fits into this. They didn't It's not that they didn't want to bring in someone who could anchor the rotation and move immediately to the front of the rotation, but that contract and that person really wasn't out there for them. So I think when you look at it, it's a very solid signing for them. They will continue to look around and see if they can't get some guys a minor league contract, and they certainly haven't ruled out trying to trade for another starter, because they need all the starters they can get. But this sets them in pretty good shape going into the season. You can see a conceivable big league rotation.
And that's not the only pitching move they made. So there's some that maybe haven't gotten a lot of attention. Well, first of all, John Axford signing a minor league deal. This is another one that's just not one of those, come to camp and we'll entertain you kind of thing. I mean, if he makes the club, he's going to make a pretty nice salary. And we're talking about the bullpen now, but he's got a pretty good track record. So that could be a big addition to them if that works out.
That's right. He's a guy who has been a closer. And Walt Weiss and Jeff Breidich have talked about adding power-type arms to the back of the rotation. The back of the bullpen. LaTroy Hawkins is still the closer, but if for some reason he slides into a setup role, they'll have to have a power arm back there to take it. They do have Adam Ottavino, who's a fairly young pitcher, and he throws the ball hard. Could he slide eventually into a closer's role? Could Rex Brothers come back from a bad year last year and end up the closer? Or could a John Axford come in here and really pitch lights out and close some games for the Rockies? What you want, yeah, you need a closer, but you also, and seeing the games of Coors Field, how they turn in the 6th, 7th, and 8th inning, you really need power arms throughout the back end of the bullpen. So John Axford fits that very well. He's a veteran type. He's been through some good times and rough times, and you certainly have those when you pitch for the Rockies at Coors Field. So if you look at it, yeah, it's a minor league contract, but it's a contract for a guy who they have some plans for. And also, if Rafael Betancourt, who is a very good closer for this team, if he is truly back from his elbow surgery of a couple of years ago, he's there on a minor league contract also. So they do have some guys who've had some experience late in ball games, and that could make a difference.
And they made a trade with the Braves. I don't think a lot of people talked about, but they added some right-handed depth. I mean, when you're talking about two guys, actually one's 27, one's 26, and we're not talking young, but still relatively young. It's funny to say that 27 isn't that young, but in baseball terms, it's just right in the middle of the road. It's on David Hale and Gus Schlosser. I'm sure I'm probably not saying that right. But so they'll sort of be, I guess, in the starting mix when spring training comes. I mean, I know that That's usually kind of how front offices frame it. They just say, well, you know, this guy's going to be in the mix for starting job, but then a lot of these guys end up sort of fitting into the bullpen somewhere. So where do you see these guys sort of fitting in this year?
I am really intrigued by the acquisition of David Hale, a guy who had a 3.30 ERA pitching a full season with the Braves last year, his first full season in the major leagues. Yes, he's 27, but the Rockies are looking at him, at his ground ball potential, at his ability to throw the ball hard, thinking that this may be the time for him to take off and become a major league type pitcher. I mean, a lot of guys, that happens around the 27, 28, 29-year-old range. And if he is able to come in here and impress them, then he may be able to work his way into the rotation. I mean, what they don't want to, when they came to camp, what they didn't want to do is just hand guys jobs. And having, you know, having a David Hale here who could work his way into the opening day rotation and maybe upset the apple cart a little bit, they don't mind that as long as he goes out there and gives the team a chance to win. So Hale has added some depth. Schlosser, he's a sidearm type guy, sinks the ball, does get ground balls, struggled a bit in his big league debut last year. I think it was like 14 games with the Braves, but you look at what he's been able to do in the minor leagues, and if he does learn from what happened last year, he could be a very good piece. We don't know if he's a starter or a reliever. I think he profiles a little bit better as a relief pitcher, but we'll see what happens. I think that the Rockies, what they're trying to do is get as many live arms as possible into camp and let them all battle it out and not have too many preconceived notions when it comes to what roles these guys pitch in. And let's face it, if you look at the Rockies over the years, guys struggle, guys do get hurt, so it's better to have more pitchers than you need.
Yeah, I mean, any veteran baseball person would say, get all the pitching you can, and when you think you have enough pitching, go get more pitching. And I guess that's even more true with the Rockies.
Right, yeah, especially with the Rockies. And don't forget, they do have a number of prospect types that we've talked about before, whether it's John Gray or Eddie Butler or even Chad Bettis, that they tried in the bullpen but now are moving back to a starting rotation type thing. And Tyler Matzik and Jordan Lyles did very well for this team last year. So there's a lot of youth that could carry this team for a number of years there. So right now you're looking at depth. You're looking at a number of arms now. Can you predict what they'll do? That seems to be very hard here. But if a few of them turn out to be good, then they're set for a few years. If a few of them turn out to be good now, then you're talking about a team that a lot of people expect to finish in the bottom of the division, suddenly finding themselves contending because the young arms have produce maybe a year or two ahead of what you think the schedule would be.
Now, while we can't have too much pitching, there are times when teams can have too much catching, and that seems to be one of the situation with the Rockies. And I know Jeff Bright talked recently just about how Will and Rosario, who they're trying to have him transition to maybe first base, possibly the outfield, just because there's you know, with the addition of Nick Hundley, there might be not really enough playing time from behind the plate. So I know that he recently, I guess, spent some time at the team spring training complex trying that out a little bit. Has there been any updates on that, or is that going well?
We'll have to see in spring training. Yes, they sent him to the complex in Scottsdale a little back in January, and also I believe it was last week he went to the Dominican Republic and also worked out at their complex there. Basically, they're not making him a first baseman full-time because they have Justin Morneau there, but if you look at how things are set up with the first base and catching situations, you'll have to rest Morneau a certain amount of time. You know, he's getting up there in age, still a very good hitter, and you can always rest him against the tough left-handed hitters. And if you look at Nick Hundley and also Michael McHenry, they're both right-handed hitters, but they tend to hit right-handed pitching better than left-handed pitching. Well, Willian Rosario, his numbers are really potent against left-handed pitchers. So you can see him getting starts behind the plate, getting some starts at first base, maybe in those long games that we tend to have at Coors Field, maybe finishing a game in the outfield or having to go out there after pinch hitting. That's all I expect in the outfield. But what they're trying to do is find ways to get his bat into the lineup because his bat makes a difference against lefties. And certainly in the NL West, you have a number of very good ones, guys that are perennial all-star types and Cy Young competitors that are left-handed.
Well, something to keep our eye on, and we will do that. And, Thomas, thank you so much. We will talk to you next week.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to have something to talk about.
As usual, I am joined by my friend and colleague, Steve Gilbert, who covers the Diamondbacks for MLB.com. And, Steve, I feel like we need to start with the catching situation because I know that I have been a little skeptical of the Diamondbacks' plan behind the plate. And I did see recently that they signed Gerald Laird to a minor league deal, a very long career backup catcher. Normally that transaction wouldn't really, you know, turn that many heads, but given the Diamondbacks' kind of uncertain situation behind the plate, he has a pretty legitimate chance, I would think, to make this team. What did you make of that when you heard the news that they had signed him?
Yeah, you know, Allison, I think they have Tuffy Goswich, and they have Oscar Hernandez, who they picked in the Rule 5 draft, who played in A-ball last year. And that was really pretty much all they have. That is all they have on the 40-man roster. And so what they've done is they've tried to put together some veterans as far as non-roster invitees. You know, Matt Pagnozzi's one, and now Gerald Laird's another. They've got Blake Lawley, who's a guy that's been in their system for a little while. Jordan Pacheco. So I think they're trying to give themselves a number of different options if they decide that, you know, Hernandez might not be ready for the big leagues, or I should say, if they're not able to acquire another catcher before opening day, because I still, like you, think that at some point they're maybe during the spring when the market for catchers sorts itself out a little bit or the price comes down for catchers, that they'll find themselves a catcher out there. But if not, I guess they feel like by having some veterans in camp like Gerald Laird, it gives them some additional options.
And this is a different situation. Like a lot of times when teams release the names of their non-roster invites and they'll put out a release and they'll be like, you know, 12 guys on there or whatever, and there's a lot of catchers. And there's a difference between catchers that they're really taking a look at that they really may need on the major league level. And there's also a group of catchers that are kind of like they need it for spring training. There are obviously multiple pitchers that are throwing bullpens at the same time. So there's a lot of like bullpen catching type catchers that they need to have during spring training. And then some at the end will get released. Some will, of course, get dispersed to the minor league teams. But this is an entirely different situation where I think Laird was like the sixth non-roster catcher that they signed, but obviously has the best chance of the six. But you might want to keep your eye out for some other names in that group.
Yeah, you're right. They have six non-roster catchers, so eight total catchers in camp. So obviously, it's like you said, a lot of times they do have extra catchers because they need them for the drills and the bullpens and whatnot. But here, it seems like you have a legitimate chance of being able to make a team as opposed to maybe just being a filler somewhere else.
So we've had a couple of very respectable writers come out recently with like prospect lists and ranking farm systems and ranking the top 100 prospects, of course, MLB.com, with Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis. So they recently put out their 100 prospects, and I like reading Keith Law from ESPN. I think that he does a really good job of sort of ranking them. So first, starting with the MLB.com listing, so five Diamondbacks prospects in the top 100, which is the third most of any organization. So that's pretty encouraging. Of course, prospects are just that, prospects. We don't know how they're going to pan out of the major leagues, but people are pretty high on some of these prospects in the Diamondbacks system. Would you agree?
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the things that encouraged the Diamondbacks is that two players that weren't eligible for the list because of the fact that because of the way they do the cutoff are the two Cuban free agents that they signed, Juan Lopez and Yasmani Tomas, two of who they consider their better prospects. So, in a sense, you know, you can almost look at it as they would have had seven if those guys had been eligible. So, certainly guys like Archie Bradley, Braden Shipley, Jake Lamb, Aaron Blair, and Tuki Toussaint, who made the list for them, are prospects that they feel very strongly about. And you can tell it's kind of slanted towards the pitching front because that's something the organization has made a conscious effort of over the last year or so at trying to restock the pitching from some of the trades that they've made.
And you have to consider the Diamondbacks as sort of, I mean, I realize that they didn't feel like they needed to retool. They didn't need to just, you know, rebuild or to start over or anything like that, because they felt like most of their problems last year were injury related. But they're also at a point where, yes, I mean, the farm system does need to be on the stronger side. Of course, that is pretty much applicable to every team, but really they're in a place where they have like a relatively healthy $90 million payroll, but they are going to need to infuse a lot of minor league talent, kind of moving forward. I would think that just having, nonstop funds available is probably not something that is really applies to them.
Right. And I think, with some of the trades that former GM Kevin Towers made in terms of trading away Tyler Skaggs. That would have been a scoop for you there if Patrick Corbin had traded. But trading Tyler Skaggs, trading Trevor Bauer. I mean, Ian Kennedy. I mean, there were a lot of trades where pitchers left the organization. So one of the things that Dave Stewart said when he took over was he wanted to kind of rebuild that. You saw that with like the Red Sox when they traded Wade Miley for a pair of pitchers, Alan Watson and Ruby De La Rosa. They tried to get two pitchers back. They did that by trying to get getting Hellickson from Tampa. So they've tried to get pitching in just about every deal that they've done during this off season to kind of build up that inventory of young pitching.
So one of the things that we've talked about quite a bit over the off season since Tomas was signed, sort of like unofficially and then officially, was the fact that they're going to be looking at him at third base. And so I want to check in with you if there's an update on any progress with him. I know he's been working over there, and have there been any recent reports about how that's going?
You know, we got to meet him last week. Based on conversations with Chip Hale and with Dave Stewart, they seem to feel optimistic of how he's looked so far, but it's still just drills and not game action. So he probably still has a ways to go. But as of right now, they're still optimistic that he'll be able to play over at third base, which would be huge for them, because otherwise it kind of creates a logjam in the outfield if he has to move to left field. So the early returns, and I caution by saying they're very early, have been that, he's shown some good footwork over there, kind of learning the position, relearning the position, learning how to play it. They've shown positive signs so far.
Our friend Will Leach over at Sports on Earth, so our friend and colleague Will Leach, he had a really cool story recently, just kind of ranking, like taking every team and listing the top three rivals that each team has. And I found it fascinating because I really, didn't disagree with anything. And when I was reading through it, I thought, that's true. I can see that. And it's just funny because when it comes to the Diamondbacks, that are a young team, I mean, they've not been around that long. It's hard to really like define like what a rivalry is, and they don't really have like geographical rivalries. So of course, the first one that Will listed was the Dodgers. And it really only comes from the pool incident. Do you think that's like a healthy way to create a rivalry? And what do you think would need to happen? Like, as far as really, like, when would the Diamondbacks? For the people who are listening, it's the Dodgers, the Cubs, and the Rockies is what Will listed. And I don't know. I think the Cubs maybe, because like there's just a lot of Cubs fans that are in Arizona. It's a very transient sort of fan base. But I don't know. What do you think would need to happen in order for the Diamondbacks to really establish a team that they hate for the right reasons?
Yeah, the Dodgers thing also earlier that season, that I guess going back even two seasons before that, they'd had a little bench clearing incident with, and then they had a real melee with them in 2013 before the pool incident when all those guys got ejected and suspended. So it's kind of been with the Diamondbacks, as you point out, they don't have a long history. So it seems like their rivals have kind of changed. Like initially, they had a decent rivalry with San Francisco because, they kept alternating years of winning the West between, I believe it was like 1999 and 2002 or 2003, where each team kind of took its turn winning the NL West. So that was somewhat of a rivalry. The Rockies were looked at as somewhat of a rival because they were the two newest teams in the NL West. But, yeah, I think for a rivalry to build, it takes time, and it takes having to battle them on a consistent basis for something, because geographically right now, I don't know that they really have a true rival. San Diego is the closest team, and I don't know that there's any you know, real rivalry there. So it would have to be another case where they were, where they get into a consistent back and forth with the team, kind of battling for the NL West title.
So you would think that even though they had that sort of rivalry with the Giants and both teams were good, you think that that's kind of dissipated? I mean, would you agree, like, that there would be more of a rivalry with the Rockies at this point than there would be? I mean, is there anything remaining from that Giants thing, or was it just because the Giants have gone on?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything more to the Giants thing. Again, it's hard when the Diamondbacks are not competitive because, you know, the Giants have won three of the last, you know, five World Series or whatever it is. So that's kind of dissipated. But, you know, the Dodger one is obviously a hot button for people in Arizona right now just because of the bad blood that was, you know, exists between the two organizations. I thought maybe there could be a rivalry in San Diego. You know, you had Kevin Towers here and you had Josh Burns over there. They kind of, you know, organizations kind of traded general manager, so to speak. But, you know, now Josh and KT have both moved on. So, yeah, right now it's hard to pick. If I had to pick one rival other than the Dodgers, I'm not sure who I would pick for them.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I just would like to see a day when the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers don't like each other because they're just both really good and they just duke it out. Not for any reason of people jumping to the pool, but I guess you can't really expect too much. Anyway, okay, Steve, thank you so much for your time, and we'll check in with you soon. Thank you.
Allison, always my pleasure.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, t-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.